Kita Luther.
Blog Talk Radio.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's Empowerment 365, 365 days of motivation and personal empowerment just for you. Jermaine Van Marvin Rowan coming to you part 15 of what slavery did to us with Brother George. He's going to lay it down today. We got a good show. It's called The Return of Our Glorious King. Let's get started. Right now. Better love, better love. There is no better love than for self and kind. You hear me? Better love yourself, people. And we went and showed out for this election. And so there it is. We're in the streets dancing and celebrating because we are on the move. It's now our time. So let's start out this show again with what the NAAEA is. The National African American Empowerment Association is organized to ensure that the needs of the African community is met. Well, the needs are met. Right, we got to do that through the development of programs and services that educate, inspire, motivate, and empower us, African American community, to do what we need to do to educate our children, to build businesses, to become politically astute, economically sound, culturally relevant, and educated, sophisticated, and productive in our community. And guess what? We can do it. All we have to do is simply try. So today, we're back again for Brother George. Brother George, come on in and welcome to the show.
Well, good evening, brother. And I'm glad to be here. This is part 15. It's the last part of our journey here in the Americas. And, you know, hopefully y'all will be happy with this finale.
All right, and this is part 15 of what slavery did to us. We're going through the chronicle. Go back and listen to the series. 1 through 14 is exceptional, and this one is going to be even better. Brother George, let us have our Willie Lynch moment.
Well, this evening, like I said before, anything that's like a sidetrack or a miseducation of things that we have accomplished or a certain confidence that we have in self-doing, all of that's a part of the Willie Lynch syndrome, even though it's contributed to by somebody else. But today, I'm going to read a passage from a book called The Soul of the World, and it's by Abdullah Bilal Amawali, and his former name was Andy Thomas. The Europeans had always been afraid to venture far out into the Atlantic because they believed the earth was flat and that they would fall off the edge. Only when Columbus learned that the earth is in fact round did he venture to sail around it in order to reach India. Thus, did he stumble upon the New World? But our Western textbooks do not tell us that hundreds of years before Columbus was born, the Moors were using globes to teach geography in their schools. Neither do they tell us that around the middle of the 12th century, a Moorish scientist, Moor means black, named Al-Idris, wrote a book on geography, in which he stated, the world is as round as a sphere, of which the waters are adherent and maintained upon its surface by natural equilibrium. It is surrounded by air, and all created bodies are stable on its surfaces. The earth drawing to itself all that is heavy in the same way that a magnet attracts iron. Now, all of us got good sense, and they said that Isaac Newton came up with the theory of gravity. Now, this brother lived 500 years before him. Come on, y'all. That's a theory of gravity in this brother's geography book. Now, hold on. Let me tell you a little bit more. We are also told that Columbus learned that the earth is round from a scientist named Galileo Galilei, but we are not told that I'm good, brother. We are not told that Galileo was himself a student of the Moors. Columbus, however, must have been aware of this because he employed several Moor sailors amongst his crew. The Moorish navigator was Pedro Alonso, who was given command of the flagship Santa Maria. Now, many of us, even when we went to school and learned about the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, we also found out that Pedro Alonso was his navigator. So it's like what I'm getting at is our young people are not told the real stories about the past, the real stories about who actually encouraged these people to start venturing out into the world on the high seas. And so I just wanted to give a piece there, a new book for you to venture into and find that has great, valuable information about us as a people to give us that confidence that we need at this time. But I'm going to turn it back over to Marvin now.
All right. Thank you, Brother George. It's about education, right? And that's what the NAAE is all about. People, learn your history and know your history, and we'll be in a better position to educate our children. All right, Brother George, let's get into the show, and let's start with the radical political public enemy, better known as PE.
Well, I chose public enemy because there were certain groups that were politically radical, and because they were politically radical, they really kind of helped to inspire our people. And many of them were inspired by Malcolm X. The speeches that Malcolm gave really energized and charged our people and put our people into a new mindset. Now, the people that were in Malcolm X's generation, they were afraid to talk about the stuff that he was talking about. But these young brothers and sisters that came along after that, they weren't afraid at all. And Public Enemy is one of them. Public Enemy, an American rap group whose dense, layered sound and radical political message made them among the most popular, controversial, and influential hip-hop artists in the 1980s and early 90s. The original members were Chuck D, original name Carlton Rittenbaugh, August 1st, 1960, that's his birthday, from Queens, New York. The next one was Flavor Flav. Original name was William Drayton, and he was born March 16th, 1959, in Long Island, New York. And then you got Terminator X. Original name was Norman Lee Rogers, and he was born August 25th of 1966, and he was born in New York City. And then the last but not least is Professor Griff, and the original name was Richard Griffin. Now, Public Enemy was formed in 1982 at Adelphi University in Long Island, New York, by a group of African Americans who came primarily from the suburbs, which was Chuck D and the rest of them. They weren't really, like, most of them weren't ghetto cats. You know, they came from, like, regular middle-class black neighborhoods. Public Enemy resulted and brought radical black political ideology to pop music in an unprecedented fashion on albums with titles that like party invitations and leftist and warning stickers for the right wing, like Yo Bum Rush the Show. It takes a nation of millions to hold us back. Fear of the black planet, apocalypse, and the enemy strikes back. Most popular and influential song in hip-hop history was Fight the Power. And I know y'all heard about Fight the Power. Acclaimed as Public Enemy's masterpiece, Nation of Millions revived the message of the Black Panthers and Malcolm X. Another of their outstanding works were Don't Believe the Hype and Bombastic. Now, I really hold, you know, the young brothers that's in that group in high esteem because they talked about a lot of serious political things. They weren't just talking about, you know, let's go shoot this person or this is a B, you know, and calling women out of their name and different things like that. And a lot of negative terminology about our people. They were talking politics, you know. They were a lot like some of the older rappers of the 1970s, like Afrika Bambaataa and his name escapes me, Gil Scott-Heron, you know, like those Public Enemy was talking stuff like them. Only thing, they took it into the hip-hop realm, and the young folks just gravitated towards them, and they became big for a long period of time until, you know, like the ones that wanted to wipe them out, they started opening up the doors for the gangster rappers, which basically pulled our young people in that direction and pulled them away from the conscious rap groups. But that's Public Enemy, and y'all should remember what they did for our people.
Thank you, Brother George. All I want to say is fight the power. We got to fight the power that be. Brother George, let's move on down to our legendary Marley.
Now, Bob Marley is just, he's an amazing figure. He popularized reggae in the United States and really probably throughout the world during this time period. And he was a legendary singer. He just came with a sound. He came with an uncompromising political realization of what was happening to us as a people throughout the world. Because Bob Marley wasn't from the United States. He was from the islands. And so when he came with that smooth, you know, sound that he brought, you know, that spirituality that was in his voice and the heavy quotes that he came with, I mean, Bob Marley was just an amazing brother. He was an amazing brother. I'm going to read a little bit about who Bob Marley was because I think it, you know, at this point it deserves that. Legendary reggae singer and writer Bob Marley was the first international superstar to shatter the negative stereotypes associated with third world countries and sell over 75 million albums worldwide. Born on February 6, 1945, Bob Marley started out with the band called the Wailers, the greatest band of Jamaica. Together, they brought up the beat that conquered the world. In 1974, after the Wailers disbanded, Marley pursued a solo career and continued to polarize reggae music, becoming a global inspiration to popularize reggae music, becoming a global inspiration and mainstream icon. Once again, if I take some of these people out of their context as far as chronological order, you know, like they belong in the 80s and 90s instead of the 2000s, you know, I apologize for that. But I couldn't, when I thought about these figures, I couldn't leave Bob Marley out. His image has become a symbol of freedom and the fight against oppression. When you say Bob Marley's name, people think of a fighter against oppression. Marley sent powerful messages through his lyrics and created spiritual experiences whenever he performed on stage. Now, what I want to do is I want to read to you some of Bob Marley's quotes. If she's amazing, she won't be easy. If she's easy, she won't be amazing. If she's worth it, you won't give up. If you give up, you're not worthy. Savvy brother. Some people feel the rain, others just get wet. Sometimes people can say some things, man, that really can take you to another level with thinking when you start evaluating. Who are you to judge the life I live? I know I'm not perfect, and I don't live to be, but before you start pointing fingers, make sure your hands are clean. The truth is, everyone is going to hurt. Just got to find the ones worth suffering for. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Better to die fighting for freedom than to be in a prison all the days of your life. The greatest of men is not in how much wealth he acquires, but in his integrity and his ability to affect those around him positively. And we need to love Bob Marley. That's my brother Bob.
All right, Brother George, all I have to say to that is Exodus, movement of Jah people. And that's what happened with this election. Jah people moved on this election, and our people will continue to move forward with power and authority. All right, let's move to the multi-genius and multi-talented rapper and actor, my brother Tupac, man, Shakur.
Well, y'all know that earlier on I spoke about Tupac's mother. And Afeni Shakur. Tupac in his full name was Tupac Amaru Shakur. His original name at birth was Lassane Parrish Crooks. He got two by names, which is Tupac and Machiavelli, you know, the nicknames that he created for himself. He was born on June 16, 1971 in Brooklyn, New York, and he died September 13th in Las Vegas, 1996 in Las Vegas, Nevada, an American rapper and actor who was one of the leading names in the 1990s gangster rap. Now, Tupac was born Lassane Crooks, and he was born to Afeni Shakur, who was his mother, a member of the Black Panther Party, and she renamed him Tupac Amaru Shakur after Peruvian revolutionary Tupac Amaru II when he was 1 year old. He spent much of his childhood on the move with his family, which in 1986 settled in Baltimore, Maryland, where Tupac attended the elite Baltimore School of the Arts. He distinguished himself as a student both creatively and academically, but his family relocated to Marin City, California, before he could graduate. There, Tupac took to the streets, selling drugs and becoming involved in the gang culture that would one day provide material for his rap lyrics. In 1990, he joined Digital Underground, an Oakland-based rap group that he scored a Billboard Top 40 with the novel single, The Humpty Dance. Shakur performed on two digital underground albums in 1991. This is the EP release, Sons of the P, before his solo, Tupacorius. Tupacorius, later that year. Now, I focus on some of the things. Tupac was in the same class with Ice Cube, Ice-T, a lot of the really well-known rappers. But the reason why I picked Tupac instead of those figures is because Tupac was like, his music eventually became a topic of study in college courses. They have a course where they study what Tupac wrote about because he was so deep in what he was saying that people realized that he actually had a certain, he had a theme to what it was that he was talking about. He wasn't just rhyming, you know, like dollar for dollar and stuff like that. He actually was delivering a message to people many times to inspire them. And so he made a song that I thought was very impressive to women when he said, keep your head up, you know. And the lyrics to that song was meant for females. And instead of calling them B-I-T-C-H's, he was trying to tell them, you know, like, if you're going through hard times, whatever, you know, keep your head up. Then he made a really serious song to his mother, which they said that sometimes they didn't have such a very good relationship, but other times it was outstanding, you know, in Dear Mama. And when I listen to Dear Mama, you know, like, I'm very touched by that song. You know, I'm very touched by that song when I hear it. And then the other thing is like I said before, in music, there are music classes that study Tupac's music. On the university level, it's not all artists that get their music studied, you know. Not to say that Tupac was an outstanding actor, you know, in Poetic Justice and Juice. And he played in another motion picture with as a cop. And I can't, the name of that movie, I could see the two stars in it, him and this white guy, but he was a tremendous actor, man, just to, you know, to jump into something and go from being a rapper, just like Ice Cube and Ice-T, you know, he was a tremendous actor. And then the other thing is that within Tupac's lyrics, he loved to read books. He was an avid reader, and he read a lot of books. And so if someone wants to get into a conversation with Tupac, they wouldn't know that this guy is so educated because he read so many books. That's why when he did the thing with Machiavelli, you know, which is the book called The Prince, where Machiavelli was kind of hired out by the government to teach the prince, which was a young boy about 10 years old, like how to rule a kingdom. And so that's really what Machiavelli, you know, the Prince Machiavelli, the book itself, was really all about. And he had read that book, and that's why he was throwing a lot of knowledge out about that classical book, you know. And he, in his songs, he would try to inspire young blacks to read, to actually go out and read books, so that we could better educate ourselves, you know, to understand the world that we live in, you know. Tupac, you know, he was killed after attending a prize fight with Mike Tyson. You know, he was shot and killed, and it was very sad. But the funny thing is that Tupac actually lived on and still had albums that were in the wing that they continued to produce his albums for years after he had passed away because he had done so much material. But I really respected his work. I think that he delivered a message that was necessary for our young people at that time. And that's why I chose to put Tupac in the category of doing something to help bring our people out of the condition that we're in. Because remember, all of this is like telling you our story of how we evolved from the time that we left slavery. So that's Brother Tupac Shakur.
Death is not the greatest loss in life. The greatest loss is what does inside, what dies inside while you're still alive. Never surrender, Brother Tupac Shakur. You're listening to NAAEA Community Conversations with Brother George. It's part 15 of What Slavery Did to Us. And I want you to also remember that we're doing NAAEA Empowerment Saturday every Saturday at 2 p.m. It's your conversation. It's your time to say what it is that's on your mind as there are situations that impact and affect our community. We always talk about something. Join our show. Listen to what we got going on. All right, Brother George, let's move on down to the king of the court, and that would be the king as a real man, LeBron James.
I really have a great, great respect for LeBron James. LeBron James became an immediate star after skipping college to join the NBA's Cleveland Cavaliers. He led the Miami Heat to NBA titles in 2012 and 2013 and won another championship with Cleveland in 2016 before joining the Los Angeles Lakers. Now, he also won a title with them also, so that puts him at four. LeBron James was born on December 30th, 1984 in Akron, Ohio. At an early age, James showed a natural talent for basketball. He was recruited by St. Vincent St. Mary's High School to join their basketball team in 1999. Overall, James scored 2,657 points, 892 rebounds, and 523 assists during his 4 years there. As a freshman, he won the Division III state title. As a sophomore, he won the Division III state title. As a junior, he was named the Parade Magazine's High School Basketball Player of the Year, the Gatorade Player of the Year, and following the end of his junior year, James was such a strong ball player that he really was considering going pro after his junior year in high school. He wasn't even going to finish high school. But he decided to return and finish high school, and he didn't win the title in his junior year. But in his senior year, he came back. He averaged 31 points a game. He won his third state title, and he went into the NBA draft. And in 2003 season, LeBron made history when he became a member of the Cleveland Cavaliers to win NBA Rookie of the Year award, and he also became the youngest player at 20 years old to receive this honor. Now, the thing that really impressed me the most was that LeBron James, you know, opted out of his contract in 2014, and he returned to Cleveland. And he returned to Cleveland because of his heart. was in Cleveland. You know, yeah, he wanted to win championships, and so he did. But once he did that, the people that loved him, the people that really believed in him, he went back to give them a championship. And you can't help but respect that. You know, people could say what they want to about LeBron James, and I guess you could tell that he's one of my favorites. He's not my favorite NBA player. It's Julius Erving, because I'm a Philadelphia fan. But he is one of the most respected athletes in my lifetime because of the different things that he's done. And he eventually led the Cavaliers to the championship, and it came from a 3-1 deficit. And he and Kyrie Irving, they carried that load and, you know, won Game 7 and gave Cleveland its first championship, you know, in NBA history. And I really respected that, and I really thought that it took a hell of a man to think about the fact that when he left Cleveland, that Cleveland essentially started drying up, and that he had become Cleveland's economy. And he realized that and went back. And when he went back, I think he built some things and put some things in place so that the economy wouldn't be hurt so bad if he decided to leave again. But he came back to save his city, to save the brothers and sisters that lived in the neighborhood that he grew up in, you know, and I can't do anything except respect that. Now, the other thing is that I really, really respect is LeBron James's work in the community as a philanthropist. I mean, the professional basketball player essentially gives LeBron James has never let his fame go to his head. He set up the LeBron James Family Foundation. The foundation raises donates money for several charities. These include the Boys and Girls Club of America, the After School All-Stars, the Children's Defense Fund, Gabriel's Angle Foundation, and One Times One. Now, the one that is probably his biggest and most involved is the After School All-Stars. LeBron Foundation began the After School All-Stars for the children of his hometown in Akron. The foundation has raised money and donated to the charity for many years. It began as a bike-a-thon, Wheels for Education, to raise money for children in Akron to have help with education and a place to go after school. It developed into a program to help at-risk children of Akron in a variety of ways. The program provides mentoring and help with education as well as extracurricular activities. The goal is to keep kids in school and encourage them to graduate. It begins in the third grade when students need to reach state standards to move up into the fourth grade. So apparently they have a particular standard that the kids have to meet once they get into the third grade in Akron. And he wanted to make sure that they would move to that next level. The program provides reading and math help for children who need the mentoring and discourages them from dropping out of school before graduating. Overall, LeBron Foundation has raised over $40 million for the program. Recently, LeBron teamed with the University of Akron to provide scholarships. The children must participate in the program, and parents are encouraged to participate. LeBron is very involved with the program. When he cannot be there, he connects with the children via social media. The program currently sponsors over 800 children. The first graduating class will be in 2021. The scholarship covers $9,500 annually college tuition for each student. LeBron hopes to extend the program throughout the state of Ohio. And I really, you know, I thought that was an admirable thing, you know. Back to his hometown of Akron. I'm sorry. Now, his Children's Defense Fund. The Children's Defense Fund started in 1973. Its purpose is to be a voice for children's rights and make sure that all children are treated equally and fairly. The LeBron James Foundation is a major contributor to the nonprofit organization. As with the After School All-Stars, the program focuses on at-risk children who come from poor backgrounds and helps these children complete their education. Now, the one that I think that many people are the most familiar with is the I Promise School. Most recently, James has made headlines because he built his brand new I Promise School for at-risk youth in his hometown of Akron, Ohio. The news isn't surprising, as James has proven how much he values education. This is the same guy who paid for 1,000 kids to attend college and started Wheels for Education, a program that provides school supplies, access to computers, and even bicycles to low-income kids. We want every kid that walks through this school to be inspired, to come away with something where they can give back, James said on a CNN interview with Don Lemon. For kids in general, all they want is to know that someone cares. And when they walk through that door, I hope they know that someone cares. And y'all, that's Brother LeBron James, you know, and he's highly respected in my book, and he's a real man, because a real man stands up for his people. He doesn't just run around and sell sneaks to people and get $1 billion, you know, from doing that and then never give nothing back. You know, so the athletes, the brothers who can't afford to give, the entertainers who can't afford to give, they give, I salute them. And today I'm going to salute LeBron James.
All right. LeBron James, a real man, a real friend, and a real brother to our people. Brother George, let's move on to the first African-American Commander-in-Chief, number 44, President Barack Obama, the 44th President of the United States of America.
Well, I really am proud of Barack Obama. I'm going to say a little bit about him before I get into my personal thoughts. Barack Obama served as the 44th president of the United States. His story is the American story. Values from the heartland, a middle-class upbringing in a strong family, hard work, and education as the means of getting ahead, and the conviction that a life so blessed should be lived in service to others. Barack Obama served as the 44th president of the United States. His story is a blessing to others. With a father from Kenya and a mother from Kansas, President Barack Obama was born in Hawaii on August 4th, 1961. He was raised with help from his grandfather, who served in Patton's army, and his grandmother, who worked her way up from the secretarial pool to middle management at a bank. Now, the secretarial pool apparently was the pool where, you know, they sit and do a lot of typing and paperwork to middle management, you know, meaning that she was like a vice president or something to that effect. After working his way through college with the help of scholarships and student loans, President Obama moved to Chicago, where he worked with a group of churches to help rebuild communities devastated by the closure of local steel plants. He went on to attend law school, where he became the first African-American president of the Harvard Law Review. Upon graduation, he returned to Chicago to help lead a voter registration drive, teach constitutional law at the University of Chicago, and remain active in his community. He was elected the 44th President of the United States on November 4th, 2008, and sworn in on January 20th, 2009. He and his wife, Michelle, are the proud parents of two daughters, Malaya and Sasha. If I pronounce those names wrong, please forgive me, y'all. Now, Barack Hussein Obama II was born in Honolulu, Hawaii, and once again, he had a father that was from the continent, from Kenya, and his mother was from the United States, but they eventually moved to Hawaii. Now, some of the things that Barack Obama accomplished in his first 100 days as the president. Between Inauguration Day and August the 29th of 2009, the Obama administration took action on many fronts. For his efforts during his debut in office, the Nobel community in Norway awarded Obama the 2009 Nobel Peace Prize. In his first 100 days in office, Obama coerced Congress to expand health care insurance for children and provide legal protection for women seeking equal pay. A $787 billion stimulus bill was passed to promote short-term economic growth. Housing and credit markets were put on life support with a market-based plan to buy U.S. banks' toxic assets. Loans were made to the auto industry, and new regulations were proposed for Wall Street. Obama cut taxes for working families, small businesses, and first-time home buyers. The president also loosened the ban on embryonic stem cell research and moved ahead with a $3.5 trillion budget plan. Now, all of these things that I'm talking about are things that somebody else is trying to take credit for, either they're trying to dismantle, you know, great programs that were put into effect. But they always talk about Barack Obama did this horrible job and all this, but actually you need to do your research and actually find out what did the brother do while he was in office. Obama undertook a complete overhaul of America's foreign policy. He reached out to improve relations with Europe, China, and Russia, and to open dialogue with Iran, Venezuela, and Cuba. He lobbied allies to support a global economic stimulus package. He committed an additional 21,000 troops to Afghanistan and set an August 10th date for withdrawal and nearly all United States troops from Iraq. In more dramatic incidences, Obama ordered an attack on pirates off the coast of Somalia and prepared the nation for a swine flu outbreak. He signed an executive order banning excessive irrigation techniques in the prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, and he eventually shut that down. Now, when you actually are paying attention to the different things that he accomplished and that he put into motion, it was really more than just the Affordable Health Care Act. He did a lot of things to create a more healthy environment in the Middle East. He also did things to create a healthier relationship with Cuba, which is one of the neighboring countries, and it's a black country. And so I think that when Donald Trump got in, he immediately shut that down. But why would you shut down commerce from a country that they're running over there and bringing back black market cigars and all? Why are you going to do that? But you don't want to trade with the person. You don't want everybody to be able to take advantage of that, but you want to take advantage of it. You know, it's like there's a lot of hypocritical things that go on in this country, and Barack Obama was a victim of that. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Affordable Health Care Act. In spite of the opposition from congressional Republicans and the populist Tea Party movement, Obama signed his health care reform plan, known as the Affordable Health Care Act, into law in March of 2010. The new law prohibited the denial of coverage based on pre-existing conditions, allowed citizens under 26 years old to be insured under their parents' plan until they got to be 27, provided for free health screenings for certain citizens, and expanded insurance coverage and access to medical care to millions of Americans. Now, I'm going to take the time to say a little bit about what the Tea Party was. Now, it's just like back in Malcolm's time when he said, a Dixiecrat and a Democrat is the same thing. He said, just because they call them Dixiecrats, that's a Democrat. Well, the Tea Party are Democrats that were disgruntled with a black man being president or even running for president. The Tea Party was Democrats. Why are they separate from the Republicans if they're the Republican Party? If they're independents, why did they separate themselves from independents? They didn't separate themselves from either of those groups. The Tea Party is actually Democrats that were disgruntled because a black man was running on their ticket. And so they formed the Tea Party and did all these things that you see up until today, including Donald Trump, who is really a Tea Party candidate. So I just wanted to speak a little bit on the Tea Party while the name was like fresh in our minds. Obama gained a legal victory in June of 2012 when the United States Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Health Care Act individual mandate, which requires citizens to purchase health care or pay a tax, in a 5-4 decision, the court decided the health care law signature provision fell into the taxation power granted to Congress under the Constitution. And so that's what y'all all know, that they're debating about that today, even today. It's actually today that they're debating about whether or not that's legal. And I believe that the courts upheld most of the Affordable Health Care Act anyway. Now, one of the last things that he did was he came up with the Clean Power Plan, which was in August of 2015, Obama administration announced the Clean Power Plan, a major climate change plan aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The first ever national standards to limit carbon pollution from coal-burning power plants in the United States. The plan became the administration's main tool to meet the emissions reduction target from the Paris Climate Agreement, the same thing that Donald Trump got out of as soon as he got into office because Barack Obama started it. You know, just a jealous man over a very intelligent black man that he was jealous of. You know, but Barack Obama faced huge challenges just being a black man in that office, and they fought him tooth and nail with every single little thing that he was trying to accomplish. But guess what? He still accomplished them. That just showed, you know, how much character that this brother had. You know, he picked the outstanding cabinet that knew how to maneuver and get the things done that he wanted to get done, even though Mitch McConnell was doing the same thing to him. Well, he did the same thing to him that he's still doing today, and he still was able to maneuver through all of that. And he gets criticized because he didn't accomplish what he set out to accomplish. But in life, all of us ain't going to accomplish every single thing that we set out to accomplish. But I take my hat off to the brother, and I'm very proud that he was the first of us to be the president of this country, and he did a fine job, and we should all always remember our president, Brother Barack Obama. And we're going to call him number 44, just like they call Trump 45. But 44 means something good. I'm out, y'all.
All right, brother. Change will not come if we wait for some other person or some other time. We are the ones we've been waiting for. We are the change that we seek. Barack Obama, number 44. Our main man. He's the example. He's the start. It's happening now. So this is the end of our series and segment 15 of What Slavery Did to Us. And we chronicled our experiences here. I want you guys to go back into the archives and listen to them. Share with your friends and family. There's a great history that we have. And we're talking about the African-American experience that prior to being here, all of the things that Brother George shared, our Willie Lynch moments, all of the information you have access to now. So if you want to learn your history, you want to learn a little bit more about it and fall into line with our education component of the NAAEA, then go back and do yourself a good service and look at what you could do with episodes 1 through 15 in terms of what slavery did to us and the great job that Brother George did. So I want to thank you, Brother George, for doing a wonderful job. You have happened.
Marvin Rome. And I'm very serious about that, y'all. Some years back, Brother Marvin and I had spoke about doing an interview series, and I always wanted to know our history here in this country. And it's an old saying that to learn something on a high level, teach it. And so in the process of me doing this series of lectures on, well, it's not really a series of lectures, series of interviews on our time here and our experience, I learned a great deal myself, you know, about some of the people that I really hadn't studied and known a great deal about, just because you hear someone's name, you know, it doesn't mean that you actually know them. But I mean, I got to know some figures in our history that were very significant, and I have a much greater appreciation for our experience here in the Americas. I have a much greater appreciation. So that's basically it, brother.
All right, thank you, Brother George. Another question is, what was your favorite episode and why?
I think that my favorite episode was the episode of the 1930s with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Marcus Garvey. They have always been, and I believe that W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington were also in that cluster. And that episode was my favorite because it actually was the episode that pushed forward into history is what shaped my mind to be a black nationalist, was the thoughts that they put out there about self-determination and do for self and how to look out for your own people and work together with your own people. And I grew up in an environment where our people always were challenging what we could do. You know, you can't do nothing. An N can't do nothing. You know, an N ain't never been nothing, all that. And I heard that so many times that it really was, it was more of an inspiration to me to prove those people wrong. And some of those people were people that I loved, that were very close to me. But I heard that over and over again from our people growing up in the 60s. And to me, you know, when I heard, you know, voices of men that really believed in our people, that really believed our people could do things, man, that inspired me, you know. And it inspired me when the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, you know, brought the nation back. You know, that's where I was inspired by those things. You know, that our people could climb from the depths, you know, of being enslaved to being able to have our own economy, you know, like with the Black Wall Street. Those time periods, you know, with our people are great times, and that was a great example for me. So I would have to say that particular one was the one that was the most inspiring to me.
All right. Well, mine was the part 11 with Black Scholars and part 7, Black Wall Street. But also, and I want you to speak to this before we leave, the need for a collective consciousness. Would you speak to that? And then at the very end, tell us about your vision for our people and our future.
Well, the idea of collective consciousness is that we need to get into the same mind once again. We have to get into a position in the world where we basically are learning the same things about ourselves. We're teaching that to our young people. We're giving our young people pride. We're teaching our young people, you know, the same heroes, you know, and we're getting into, you know, a collective consciousness and rebuilding a strong culture to take us into, you know, the next phase of black people in the world. And that essentially is what my vision is of what our people can do. And hopefully we can build a strong enough economy from within that we can structure our HBCUs to really be HBCUs and help to resonate that thought of a collective consciousness where we come out of there with a sense of pride and dignity and a newfound self, you know, and that's what my vision is for our people in the future.
All right. Thank you, brother. And thank you all for joining us. It's been NAAEA Community Conversations with Brother George, part 15 of What Slavery Did to Us. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you soon.
What you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. If we just let it be, na 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 na, the world won't get no better. We gotta change it, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me.